not say any of the things he wanted. He would never have been able to say them anyway. That he was leaving as a traitor, soon to slink off like a dog in the night. That to set his own life back to rights, he must turn away from a good man, to leave him to his own fortune. He regretted whatever might happen to Michael after he left. That was what he wanted to say, but did not say. He noticed Michael looking intently at him, his eyes overcast with worry. "I wonder," Michael said in a slow voice, "why you are more concerned with John Sousa than with the lights in the sky. I would think you would be enraptured even to think this could be the return." "I know I am." Marvel smiled, a bit sad. "I have always detested Sousa. Much to your chagrin, I know. The thought of him wasting his time with that charlatan galls me. Especially," he motioned upward at the sky, "when we have real evidence right in front of us." Michael slapped the table. "So you think the lights may be the return after all? I must have a horoscope about it." "You sly dog, you had me going." "They may be comets, or meteors. They might signify death for us all." "Surely they would have hit the earth by now if they were meteors," Michael said, though momentarily he looked worried. "Perhaps not. You should ask Sousa. He might know." "He would have told me if they were dangerous." Michael leaned his chair back, catching his bare feet on the other side of the table, and folded his thick arms behind his head. He was a strong man from riding and walking everywhere. Marvel had always thought him beautiful in a certain coarse, active way. The son of 30 generations of astronauts. The king gazed at the ceiling, wistful. "I must say a part of me doesn't want to know. I'm sure Sousa wouldn't be able to tell you anyway." The king ignored Marvel. "Right now, I'm not sure if I should be afraid or joyful. What a strange feeling." He chuckled again. He looked at the Hierophant, his face a disaster of hope. "What does your instinct tell you, priest? Give me guidance." But Marvel had hardened already. "I don't know what they are," he said. "I don't think anyone does." Chapter 16. A Headache. John awoke late in the morning to a vile throbbing in his temples. Leaks of light poked from around the edges of his curtains, and John scrunched down into his bed and groaned into his pillow, muffling the sound. His bed was splendidly comfortable, but all he could feel was a heavy pounding over his brows. The curtains were thick and blocked out most of the morning light, and the vast bed was overstuffed with feathers and covered in silken blankets. If Mizar heard him stirring, he would inevitably bustle inside, and then John would be duty-bound to rise. John rarely drank too much. There had been only one or two other times since he was a boy that he could recall such a revolting lapse in his judgment. He was certain, when he awoke, that he felt a good deal worse than he had the previous day, and not just physically. But why, when they had succeeded in contacting something otherworldly? It was more than John had ever achieved on his own. He barely opened one eye, but still could see by the light seeping beneath the curtains that it was far later than he normally rose. Was there any point at all to waking up and taking yet another very dangerous carriage ride back to the palace compound? Their meeting with Queen Allison. He dreaded it, even though he had news to report. Tygo and Allison's flirtation had angered him. He hated the ambiguity of emotion. This was why he had no friends, only servants. The idea of them thrilling one another with flutters of their eyelashes, as though he were a child who didn't understand. John Sousa was many things, and he did know himself to be perplexingly unattractive to most people, even though he had been blessed with a strangely handsome face, and an equally adequate body, and even a position he'd won through merit and heredity. And yet he remained unliked. There had been occasions when he did have some girl or another sent to him for pleasure, although the entire business was a distraction in the most base sense. What did he care what some low-born courtesan thought of his naked member? And yet always they seemed to judge him, rightly or wrongly, and enough of them had passed through his bedchamber that he'd decided there was no pleasing any of them. He had stopped trying. Now it was only when his own physical urges reached a distracting pitch that he even remembered he could call for one of these girls. And it was always a different one. Did they wish never to return? Or was there some rule about courtesans visiting the same man over and over? John had never thought to ask, though it might have been nice to see the same one more than once. He had given up the idea of a wife some 10 years ago. No, longer. He found the prospect of living with a woman odd. He had shared his life with Mizar and no one else for as long as he'd been a fully formed and thinking human, and he saw no reason to upset that order. His health was weak enough. He needed significant rest and time to think. Truly, the arrival of Tygo was enough of an upheaval to cause a surge in John's chronic unease, so much that the previous evening he'd drunk nearly 3 times the amount he had ever consumed in one sitting. And now he was paying the price. He turned over in his bed and finally pulled the cord on the curtain. In rushed cool gray light. Odd to see clouds. He'd imagined it would be sunny. The air was a limpid glaze over his coverlet, his arms hairy pastel tubes atop the fabric. He could not get that word out of his mind. Tell Lochbovin. Falling death. Had he been more superstitious, he might have assumed out of hand that the word portended evil. But John was not superstitious. Chronically skeptical, perhaps. Demanding of proof, certainly. Because of this quality of his character, he had begun to suspect that no shuttles were returning, ever, because none had ever existed. Or if they had existed, it was in such a way that man would never unlock their secrets to understand what they had meant to the ancients. They were as mysterious as the angels' language, artifacts of a past so distant now that it might as well have been a fiction. In the morning light, John couldn't believe he'd swallowed Tygo's little show. Now that he was sober, he saw it plainly. Yet still there remained a niggling germ of belief. In the darkest part of John's heart, a hope. Tygo's word, to Lochbovin, had remained with him, freezing his heart with fear even now, when he was no longer under the sway of Tygo's unseeing eyes. Even after his faculties had returned to normal. What had happened in that room? Suddenly he felt sick. As soon as Mizar appeared with a bowl of steaming porridge, John threw himself across the room toward the wash basin, but missed it entirely, and vomited on the floor, a scorched yellowish bile with a smell that caused him to retch again. Mizar cheerfully withdrew a rag from his back pocket. "I had a feeling, sir." John wiped his mouth, uninterested.
"I feel terrible."
"Yes," Mizar agreed. "So does Tygo Brachio. What an odd fellow, that one. Inciting you to drink. That's not like you." He spat out acrid saliva. "You know he slept all night in your office, on the sofa? With his hands still chained. I offered him a bed, but he said he preferred to be near the mirror. What a funny man."
John panted. "You let him sleep all night in my office? All my records and books are in there."
"I didn't see any harm in it. He was just as sick as you are now. It wasn't as though he was pawing at your belongings, sir." He paused. "His arms are chained."
"Have you given him free rein of my courtyard as well?"
Mizar bent stiffly and began wiping up the vomit. "I thought he was to be your assistant. I didn't know he was to be watched like a prisoner."
"He was in jail for treason. You just said he was shackled. It should be evident that he's to be watched."
"Not to me, it wasn't."
"You left him all night with my mirror and all my books.
He was only checking the mirror for faults, he told me."
John goggled at his servant. "You let him touch it again? Mizar, that mirror is perhaps the only link between our world and the heavens, and you..."
He sputtered.
"You just let a known con man finger it as though it were his own?"
Mizar stopped wiping up the vomit and glared at John.
"I don't know him to be any con man. I thought he was a walking doctor.
John hurried to dress and went at once to his study, where he found Tygo standing in a corner with a large book balanced upon his chained forearms. Gray light fell from the window onto the floor, just beyond where he stood, so he was partially in shadow. John noted with some relief that the mirror was still in its holder, unharmed, though still uncovered. He rushed across the stone floor and threw the dust cloth over it again. Despite what Mizar had said, Tygo Brachio looked just as well as he had the night before. No sign he had been sick. John ran his hands fretfully over the dust cloth, feeling the shape of the mirror beneath it.
"Good morning to you, too," Tygo chirped from behind the book. "Though maybe not so good, eh? How do you feel?"
John scowled.
"I don't recall giving you permission to scavenge my rare books. What are you looking at? Those are some of my oldest volumes, not fit for daily use. Some of them are so old I've only held them a few times for cataloging. Don't touch them."
Tygo held the book up.
"This one isn't too fragile. I don't know what you're so excited about."
He eyed the mirror, John's hands on it.
"Got it in your head that I'm a thief, did you?"
John flushed.
"It's Lord Astronomer to you. You are to call me by my title, and you are not to read my books. You are not to do anything, unless I say so. Give me that."
He extended his hand, and Tygo, snickering, gave him the book.
"Oh, I think you've read that particular one more than a few times."
John turned it over and looked at the spine. "Sexual astrology, effective positions for begetting heaven's children."
"Were you intending to beget yourself some star children?"
Tygo's eyes furrowed with laughter.
"Tell me, have you used any of the techniques in here? It's so stupid. Look at this."
He snatched it back and opened it.
"The position for a boy will be best achieved after a thorough massage to the feet and legs. You will find the leg massage tilts the cervix back, allowing for easier passage of the seed."
Tygo flipped the pages.
"There's more. Caress the underside of the breasts. Elementals delight in a winding motion applied to the nipples." "Did you know that a leg massage opens the cervix?"
"I didn't."
John grabbed the book.
"I've never read this book."
"But the drawings. You've looked at those."
Tygo turned it sideways.
"It has very good drawings."
John felt a glut of hate and jealousy for Tygo rising in his throat like more vomit.
So at ease all the time,
talking, poking fun, slinking along as though everything were a joke when almost nothing ever was.
"It may astonish you," John snapped, "but some people think about more important things than sex. That book is a relic. I inherited it from my father's library, and I imagine he inherited it from his own father's ad infinitum. If you'd bothered to look,"
now he was stammering,
"you'd have noticed that this corner of the library is dusty. In fact, I hardly ever come here. Not that I could expect you to possess such basic powers of observation, being that you are a drunk. Now,"
he took a long, slow breath,
"we're late already for our audience with Allison, although I don't know what we'll tell her. We haven't even begun studying the transcription."
Tygo's face lurched with pleasure.
"There was a message from her earlier. She wishes for us to meet her at her golf course, since you were so late getting up. Did you know she plays golf?"
John could feel his still hot face.
"Everyone knows that."
"Fine. Sorry for asking," Tygo said.
"I'm sorry too," was all John could think to say.
"The Hierophant will play golf with us."
Tygo's eyes became strange and bright. John's head throbbed.
"That's just wonderful. He will surely have plenty of wrong-headed suggestions about how we should do our jobs. He always does."
He sighed.
"You best not stare at the Queen the way you did yesterday. Marvel is her father."
"I gathered that. I think the Queen didn't mind being stared at, though."
John had to get away from the little man, or else he would surely hit him again. He did not even check that Tygo followed him out. Chapter 17. Hulda. Mr. Capellatio woke her before dawn and went at once outside to urinate, leaving her in the knot of their blankets. She heard him outside talking to someone. It was some time before she smelled and felt the green fizz of rain in the air. She was surprised she wasn't cold. And then she felt it, all at once like a slap. Pain in her thigh. In the dim light, she examined the spot. A smear of yellow copper had oozed through the bandage. It looked better than it felt. But from moment to moment, it burned so hotly, she wanted to tear off the bandage and pour cool water over it. Mr. Capellatio came back inside the tent, yawning and stretching. Today they would do the ritual. But first he had to make things ready. He seemed tired, but she could tell he had something fixed in his mind. They'd slept with their foreheads touching, but now he knelt before her while she lay on the bed, his face a limitless plane of calm. But she sensed his anxiety. "You really should read," he handed her The True King. "While you wait," she stared at it. "Orchid wrote this." "Ah, you figured it out. A girl of many talents." He pulled his hair halfway back and secured it with a tie, then looked down at her sternly. "Let me tell you something before you get ideas. I do love her. She has been an asset, a great advantage to me in many, many ways." The girl's heart contracted. "But she tried to humiliate you in front of everyone." "Her magic is a special kind. She has bent the world to my own will with her words." "She tried to kill me," the girl said in a flat voice. "That will happen." "But how can you let her try to kill me?"
"I'm not," he growled. "Leave it alone, Aurora. Read the book. When I come back, you will have read it. As much as you can."
After he left, she was angry, but she had nothing to do, so she did what he said. The carnivals began after the blood rain. They brought terror and relief by turns to the people of these lands, a people who are few enough these days, and were even fewer in times past. The people were so enraptured by the carnivals that they kept proficient records, which I have long studied to collect this history. About the origins of the execution carnivals, there can be no misunderstanding. I will tell you now how they came about. The history of the new religions and the carnivals begins some 1,000 years ago, when a rain of blood and viscera fell over a great swath of land in the center of the continent. It fell upon the place that had been called Kansas, when it was but a wasteland ravaged by the disease. The rain came from a clear sky, red drops and globs of tissue, and ever afterward people called it the blood rain. They did not know what it could be, if some gargantuan floating animal had exploded in the sky above them, or if the massacred dead from an unknown war had been lifted into the sky by a cyclone and then dumped upon them by chance, or even if the rain had been sent by evil forces or good ones. No one knew. And so the people were terrified. The blood rain occurred in April and lasted 5 days, soaking the ground in blood up to the ankles of the wild cattle that roamed freely in those days. Much to the astonishment of the Cape and the King's Court at Canaveral, the blood rain did not fall there. Even in those ancient times, the Cape was already a holy and famous place, one filled with magicians and orbital doctors. They had already embarked upon the use and refinement of magic, the outlawry of medicine, and many more tenets of our faith that we still hold to be true. They had done all these things, and yet still nothing had been able to quell the spreading of a terrible disease known as Benthead. And people were still dying, and the world had continued to grow worse in every generation. The disease killed more people in Kansas than anywhere on the continent. Some even believe the disease originated in the cattle there. Whatever the case, Kansas had become a wasteland where nothing grew. The few people who still resided there lived like wretches in tiny settlements. They were terrified to leave. In case they should stray from the roads, they had come to believe safe. They were afraid to contract Benthead. But after the blood rain, the land, so long fallow, bloomed. Wildflowers, grasses, ferns, and rushes sprang up almost overnight, carpeting the countryside. The land brought forth greenery and living creatures, and for the first time anyone could remember, There were as many calves in the fields as grown cattle, and the cattle did not seem to die as they usually did when they crossed patches of diseased ground. For several years, the world was lush, even in winter. The fall of blood had nourished the earth itself, and its beauty was excruciating. There are records of men who went mad with the splendor of it, the rolling hills of soft summer grass, and the cattle which multiplied 100-fold, and then 1,000-fold, until people could not look upon the land in Kansas without seeing cows walking dreamily from this place to that one, glossy and happy in their herds. What were the people to make of this abundance, where before there had been only death? The folk had no inkling of the forces at work, so they reveled in the glory all around them, the warm wind blowing down the prairies, the birth of new calves. They spoke to each other in hushed tones, like the entire world was a holy space. And yet they were still afraid to walk among the cattle. It was the case that the land looked beautiful, but they did not yet trust it. How many of them had watched loved ones die of bent head? It could not leave the soil. In hundreds of years it hadn't. Why should it be different after the blood rain? We still ask this question, but its answer is not one for our age. Now, in that time and in that place, lived a woman called Huldah, who would become the first prophetess. All the prophets, and ultimately the true king, descend from her line. Huldah was by then already an aged woman, and in the seasons following the blood rain, she was first among those who wanted to understand why the land had changed. Each day she went onto the safe roads and made meticulous records of what she saw. How many cattle, how many calves, where they seemed to be walking, how many dead lay around. Soon enough, there were so few dead to be accounted for merely by natural causes. Huldah kept track of the plants as well, for it seemed to her that corn grew in places where it never had been, and higher than she had ever seen in any person's small garden. And there were soybeans again in the fields, and by she even saw wheat growing. But she dared not sample these blessings, for they grew some ways off the safe roads, and she was still afraid. All the same, the people began to call the land the garden, because it overflowed with abundance. Huldah had 2 sons, Hector and Lee, but only one still lived with her in her small house in her settlement, which we still know by its ancient name, Lucas. At that time, Lucas was home to fewer than 40 people, a fair-sized settlement for that time. Huldah's older son, Hector, was married and lived in his own home, but her younger son, Lee, was her constant companion and joy. The records speak very clearly about Huldah's love for Lee, for his energetic nature, for his curiosity and mischievous ways. He went with her everywhere while she was engaged in recording the effects of the blood rain. Lee was by her side when at last she decided to sample some of the corn that had been growing, seasonless, for a year. Since the disease first ravaged the world, fields where edible food could be grown had been reduced almost to nothing, as more and more land every year was found to be infected. But after the blood rain, there had been no winter. Only more and endless greenery, shooting toward the heavens, prairie grass growing even through the cracks in people's floors. Huldah went with Lee off the safe road and out into a field, and they took in a basket of corn and boiled the ears, and then Huldah did eat one, with Lee watching and waiting to record what happened to her, and then they waited another year to see if Huldah would die of bent head. Bent head is known to strike in a very predictable way, so after a year of no illness, Huldah rejoiced that the fruit of the land was edible again. She called her son Lee to her and instructed him to inform the settlement at once. But Lee determined he must try the food as well, and he ate it and called it holy, saying it was from heaven, and Huldah declared it must have been sent by the astronauts who had left the earth so long ago. The blood rain had restored the earth at last. They went together to tell the people that the land was cured. Also at this time, Huldah, an aged woman, discovered she was pregnant, although her husband had been dead for many years. The land itself had given her a child, she said, for what else could it be? She had long ago reckoned her child-bearing years were finished, and yet she was plainly with child. Moreover, during the pregnancy, her health flourished. She blazed with vigor and walked about unencumbered through her 9th month, going from settlement to settlement and telling the people to eat the fruit of the land, for the disease had been conquered by the blood rain. She was the proof. This was the occurrence that convinced many people in Kansas that Huldah was a prophetess, as she had been inspired to observe the effects of the blood rain. Some celestial courage had made her unafraid. For her bravery, she was called High Priestess, and people came to her from then on to beg her wisdom. After the birth of her daughter, who was very respectfully named Rain, Huldah began to receive visions. Lee recorded these visions with care, so Huldah would know every detail of what she uttered in her trances. She saw visions of a king, not the king at the Cape, but a holier, innocent king, the true king, whose reign would begin when the shuttles at last returned to Earth. The astronauts who had sent the blood rain would return only when this true king sat on the throne. Only this king could save the world from destruction by the disease, and only those who followed him would ascend to heaven within the perfected shuttles. Only they would be transformed into light and cosmic radiance and on forever. Glorify. This vision gave people hope, and they were overjoyed to hear that this king would come from Kansas. Who would have thought such a cursed place might give the world salvation? Huldah's most unhappy vision, however, concerned the Kansans' ingratitude for the blood rain, which had poured from the mouth of the cosmos, a gift just when the world most required it. And how had they responded? With feasting and dancing and singing and lovemaking, but no great gesture of thanks to the astronauts in heaven for sending the rain, nor even a thought of how they should thank heaven. When Huldah awoke from her trance and read what Lee had recorded of her vision, she was struck with grief and declared that men must at once build the most beautiful tower, a tower that would rival the Cape, where the astronauts had come from. So the tower was built. It was made of an igneous stone, jet-colored, brought from the northeastern settlements, and when it was finished, Huldah called it the Black Watchtower. There the faithful would await the true king. During the years it took to build this magnificent structure, the land continued to produce staggering harvests. The garden existed in such indescribable beauty that men believed they must surely have at last stumbled on the path of righteousness. The tower was a fitting tribute to honor the cosmos, and Huldah herself was the bravest woman in history, as well as a prophetess whose words were wise and benevolent. Now, at this time, Huldah's older son, Hector, was jealous at the hand his younger brother Lee had in all their mother's affairs. Hector complained to his mother that he was the older son, and by rights her heir and right hand. But Huldah only remarked that it was Lee who had followed her into the fields, and it was Lee who had accompanied her to tell men that the blood rain had healed the land, and it was Lee who witnessed her visions and interpreted them with her. Hector had been occupied with his own pursuits during these times. Hector also protested her complacency with the perpetual growing season and the unending bounty of the land. It seemed quite an odd thing, as all Kansans were familiar with the harshness of the continental winter. Kansas had not seen a winter for many years. 4, he counted. Where was the cold? Did this aberration seem truly benevolent? Huldah chided him for his ungratefulness, and he went away unsatisfied. Hector spoke of his disbelief with Lee, and the two opposed one another greatly, in both belief and temperament, for where Lee was bright and energetic, Hector was brooding and doubtful. They argued for many hours as they walked around the tower, their voices rising as they debated the unnatural weather and their mother's favor. At last, their conflict came to blows. Lee was the smaller of the two, but he struck Hector with a stone, his strength bolstered by his unwavering devotion. Hector limped away, bleeding and badly injured. Sometime later, Hector crept into his mother's house, and there, whether driven by jealousy or humiliation or greed, he poisoned Lee's drink with hemlock, and within hours, Lee had died a terrible death, paralyzed slowly until he could no longer draw air. Hector was incarcerated in the Black Watchtower for murder, and that was where he remained. It happened that after 5 years of seasonless and overabundant growing, the land again became fallow. The marvelous numbers of cattle began not only to die, but to change. For where they had once been lustrous and fat, they were now craggy and rageful, and they grew larger but uglier than before, and men could no longer approach them. They scraped their hides on the ground for days and weeks, until they wore away much of their skins, and it hung in bloodied strips off their bodies. They teetered on skeletal legs, with eyes as dim and furious as demons. They became what we know as the Kansas cow, that dreaded creature which still roams those dark places, whose saliva can kill a man on the spot. After several weeks of this terrible existence, they ran in wild circles before they finally, mercifully, died. Man encountered other, even more monstrous creatures, the manticore being the most fearsome, and all these still exist, although they have been seen by very few who are still alive. For with their appearance, men too began dying in droves of Benthead once again. So many died that it was impossible to bury them, and even Hulda feared for her life, for she wondered if their food was poisoned again with the disease. And yet she did not die. It came to her in a vision that her son Hector was to blame for the reversal of their fortunes. His jealousy had undone them all. This vision was recorded by a different scribe, as her son Lee was dead of poison. But we have copies of this scripture, and thus can be certain of Hulda's intention. When she regained her senses after her vision, she understood that she must spill Hector's blood onto the land as a sacrifice. When Hector was taken from his jail, he was glad of heart, because he believed he had been proven correct in his misgivings. The land was now in turmoil, and they had all been wrong to trust the blood rain, but then Hector heard he was to be beheaded, so his blood would soak the earth in penitence for his ungratefulness, and he cursed his mother. He did not meet his fate willingly, but grimaced and trembled. To immortalize his indignity, and to remind all others of the consequences of ingratitude, Hulda asked her magicians to prepare his severed head in such a way as to preserve it for eternity. And ever afterward, Hulda kept the head of Hector with her at every moment, sometimes gazing upon it sadly, for he was her lost son, sometimes cursing it angrily, as he had cursed her before his death. Soon his severed head became a charm she could not do without, a bitter memorial of lost hope. Hector's blood did not stop the desolation of the land. The verdant hills regained their former character over time, dead, almost entirely poisoned, and very dangerous. They became the self-same land we know and live in fear of today. The great numbers of Kansas cow and the other beasts died as well, since the land can support very few creatures of any kind, except those which still roam those wilds and terrify men who come upon them. Hulda's visions revealed to her that her elder son's blood was not recompense enough for the slaughter of his brother, who would have been named prophet upon her death, nor for Hector's denial of the beneficence of the blood rain. A larger sacrifice was in order. She meditated on this for several years while she watched the world around her continue to die. During this time of extreme darkness, Hulda was gifted. She saw in great detail the doctrine of wonder blood, the rinsing of the world in blood for one eon. She saw the legions of heads, the stages for the executions, the blood running from the stone beheading blocks. She saw it, and she commanded her followers do just as she had seen, and thus began the eon of pain. The first carnival was Hulda's own daughter's carnival, the Rain Carnival, and this miraculously conceived daughter became the next prophetess, and it has been her line we have watched ever since for the emergence of the true king. Glorify. The carnival soon numbered many, each one believing a version of the story recorded above, although many are dangerously blasphemous and have veered from the truth. Still others are vectors only of violence and show no devotion at all, to heaven or the shuttles, or even the line of prophets. These do none of the work for which they were originally intended, bathing the world in blood until the land lives again. They only are havens of sex magic and debauchery. Cape Canaveral was the birthplace of a religion that found its perfection in another, sadder place, Kansas, the center of the universe. Only when the true king returns to the seat of heaven, the throne at the Cape, where the men first took leave of this earth and journeyed into the cosmic openness, can the world begin anew. Until then, our carnivals merely staunch the flow of humanity's evil. When the true king emerges, the shuttles will return for the faithful. This is the only truth that one must accept in order to begin the journey toward salvation, that we will be perfected and transformed and taken upward through the ionosphere. When the true king has taken his rightful place at the Cape, the Holy of Holies, when he sits upon the throne in his holy city, then surely will the shuttles arrive soon afterward. These days will be called the Days of Heaven, when the shuttles will deliver the faithful from the diseased earth and into the cosmos among our ancestors, away from the earth. Away. She put down the book. The girl remembered her mother Gimble suddenly, unbidden thoughts of her tumbling back. She had imagined Hulda in the story to be her mother. The long, dirty white hair, her doctor's bag slung across her body as she went up and down the safe roads, on a personal mission that even the danger of the disease couldn't sway. It was the only image she could conjure of such a fearless person. Yet after all this, she had still not forgiven her mother. At all. She had forgiven Mr. Capellatio, Argento even, but not her mother. When she had ridden with Gimble up to the carnival country 2 years before, her mother had said to her, "Fortune is a kind of uncontrollable ignorance, girl. You will know this soon enough." Who says such a thing to a child? The girl wondered now, angry. Her mother had spoken in her ear, seated behind her on their white mule with the faceplate. The land was wide and calm. They were the only people for 100 miles. That was what her mother had told her. Then Gimble said, "This trial will better you, will move you closer to understanding the blind indifference of the world." "There is no magic," she'd said harshly. "Only fortune, good and bad, which you can meet with ingenuity or ignorance." The girl had argued. "Where does fortune come from, though?" "It's a gift." "So it's magic?" She'd clicked her tongue. "Maybe the only magic in the world." Her mother had taught her to rely on her own resourcefulness, which was a gift, to be sure. But from who? Mr. Capellatio said magic was all around. Her fingers touched her oozing bandage, where she had branded herself with his sign of the rocket ship. Curiously proud of the strength that had taken, she had changed his mind. She had done that herself. And the brand, a pain anyone would have dreaded. She had done that herself as well. Chapter 18. The Game. John stood at the edge of Queen Allison's golf course. He had never actually stood on the course before, and he didn't know anyone who had, besides Michael. But then, he did not talk to many other courtiers. He greatly disliked their chatting and rumor-mongering, and had been not in the least regretful to leave the compound for his own Urania, where at least he could work in peace. Michael had raised a few courtiers' homes to make the course. He had known she would like it. The king himself never played, but would sometimes gaze out at her from a window in his modest house while John calculated the horoscopes, and he'd remark upon Allison's beauty as she swung her club, her long brown hair swaying with the strokes of the club. At these moments, John would pretend to look out the window as well, but really he fixed his eyes on some other point, so he would not have to look at Allison's lovely form, the pin-straight hair, the slender waist, all of which caused his heart to sputter. John stepped tentatively upon the damp grass, blinking and disorganized in the cloudy noon light. It had rained in the morning, he guessed, but now the two comets, Stella Novi, rather, since no one was yet sure what they were, twinkled weakly overhead. They did not appear any larger or brighter, but there were most certainly two of them. He searched for a third, but could not see one, so he turned his eyes to the cores, which was roughly the size of several large tents and their surrounding booths, with each hole marked by a partition containing some particular challenge, knocking the ball through a small passageway formed by several wooden blocks, for instance, or hitting the ball up a hillock, but not over the hillock. He could not see what fascination it could possibly hold for a woman such as Allison, who seemed uninterested in precision of any sort. But Michael once told him she'd read about it in an old book and had wanted to play it since she was a child. John could not grasp the point of the game. It seemed geometric, but Allison was not mathematically inclined. Perhaps it was meant to be devotional? Did she meditate on the positions of the stars while she played through the obstacles? It did not seem likely. John and Tygo were handed clubs and balls by a servant as soon as they stepped through the rickety gate and onto the course. From across the grass, Allison, dressed in loose white pants and an egg-colored tunic, lifted her own club and smiled at them. "I suppose we're actually doing this," John said dully, not even wanting to look at his companion in case Tygo was smiling effortlessly. He'd never walked on such perfect grass before, and now regretted his choice of heavy boots. "Just be yourself," Tygo said, stifling a chuckle. "I'm sure she likes you fine." "I have no thoughts on that subject," John snapped. "I'm concerned that we actually have nothing of note to tell her, since all we did last night was become drunk." Tygo swung his club in a shallow arc as they walked toward her. "That's not all I did." Then he said, "Tell her anything, man. You don't have to be nervous. She doesn't care what you say. She only wants someone to talk to her. For God's sakes, it's incredibly obvious." John snorted. "Suit yourself." He whacked his club on the ground, discontented, and said nothing. They reached her at the seventh hole, concentrating on hitting the ball a short distance into the cup, having evidently forded the valleys and sand spots within the enclosure in previous strokes. She didn't look at them until she'd hit the purple ball into the hole. When she did, her face seemed held together by strange smears of makeup. A cosmetic glaze one shade lighter than her actual skin hid her freckles, her eyebrows darkened with brown pencil. This mask moved barely at all when she greeted them, except her lips pursing into that bud. She leaned on her club and said, "I've been waiting all morning for you." "We got drunk last night," blurted Tygo, before John could even open his mouth. She appraised him with what John could clearly see was approval. "Very nice. I hope it won't affect your game. I hope one of you will beat me. No one ever does."
"So I've heard," said Tygo.
"I'm tired of going against my girls. I know all their moves. Most of them are up in bed with cramps anyway. So when is the bleeding supposed to stop?" She swung her club and turned to Tygo. "Do you like my makeup? We were bored this morning waiting for you." Tygo pretended to hit a ball.
"I don't know. It looks a little like you're trying, you know?"
Her eyes, endless green phosphorescent nuggets. "We were trying. I was thinking I could surprise Michael with it." She turned her cheek to Tygo. John watched his assistant pull suddenly back to make it seem like he did not wish to be close to her, but then bend forward from the waist to study the spackle on her face. Allison asked, "Well?"
Said Tygo. He removed a rag from an inner pocket and dangled it for her to take. His hands were still shackled. "You want to wipe some off?" She swatted him away.
"My best handmaid did it. The one who does my hair." She gestured to the length of brown silk falling down her back, but didn't ask what they thought of that. She gazed again at Tygo, not at all offended.
"You're mean," she said, smiling.
"Michael never criticizes me."
"Well, you asked," he said. "I just said what I think."
She continued to look at him,
a half-smile trapped on her lips.
Why don't they unchain you?
Shall we play some golf?
He asked brusquely.
If you're prepared to lose.
You win because you're good, not because you're the queen and no one is allowed to beat you. Right.
I always tell everyone to do their best, she exclaimed, delighted. If you can't compete, you probably shouldn't play.
And so John found himself, just as he'd feared, an observer to their coy match, a third when clearly no one needed one. Oh, he played with them, and quite glumly, but inside he alternated between seething embarrassment and dismal self-pity. Though neither he nor Tygo knew the rules to the stupid game, they kept whacking at the ball, which John surmised was meant to symbolize the moon or some other heavenly body. What other purpose could it possibly serve? Allison was correct, however. She was very good. None of Tygo's taunts, no matter when during the course of her stroke they were uttered, seemed able to upset her. Her concentration for this game flabbergasted John, but he reminded himself that people's talents could lend themselves to unexpected pursuits. One could never quite be sure who would be good at what. At last Allison, perhaps bored of showing off, placed herself directly in front of John, her square elegant head coming to his chin, and locking her eyes on his, said,
"Well, when is the bleeding going to stop? I asked you once already."
"Ah, well, we did an experiment last night that involved Tygo Brachio entering the trance state, but the information we received was hardly clear, and it shall need extensive study before we could possibly begin to..."
She pouted. "Then why did you even come here, if you don't know any more than yesterday?"
"Because you asked us to," Tygo said. She smiled at him slowly.
"So I'm just going to keep bleeding forever? How will I ever have Michael's child, then?"
Tygo's eyes went up and down her body, and John forced himself to look away, back toward the gate, where he noticed, to his surprise, Michael and Marvel Parsons standing together, deep in conversation. Michael, despite being an exceptionally tall man, the very physical ideal of a king, was dressed in unremarkable clothing, a plain white shirt with an open collar. He tended to wear his shirts until he'd sufficiently yellowed the armpits and neckband. He preferred the launderers to remove the stains with lemon juice rather than order a new shirt. The Hierophant wore his plain monk's cassock. Beside him stood the young pale-haired guard who had come for Tygo the day before. Of course Marvel was already at Michael's ear. But saying what? What had he so needed Tygo for, when surely his time was better spent planning a defense against the outlaw carnival? Should that be needed? His presence annoyed John, exhausted him. He heard Tygo remark to Allison, "Like I told you, pay no mind to the bleeding. It's bound to happen when something large upsets the gravity of Earth. Trust me," he said, snickering. "I'm a doctor."
"But the shuttles can't be that big," Allison said, doubtful. "Big enough to upset gravity? In ancient times, did all the women bleed whenever the shuttles came around?"
"Who said it was the shuttles?" Tygo asked.
"You did. I remember it."
"I said it may be the shuttles."
King Michael was pointing to the Stella Novi and gesticulating. The Hierophant, nearly as tall as the king, waited patiently until Michael was finished, then shook his head at the three golfers as though they were intruding on some previously arranged event. Tygo was saying, "The shuttles may not be like they were when they were first on Earth. We don't know what they'd be like, actually. They could be anything." He sounded so confident that even John found himself believing. Tygo tapped his ball lightly, and it fell into the cup with a pleasant clacking noise.
"Oh, good," he murmured. "I'm getting better."
John still couldn't bring himself to look at them head on, but he sensed the queen had inched her body somehow closer to Tygo, who acted like he didn't notice.
"What did you see in your trance?" she asked.
"A trance is like... it's like seeing different things out each eye at once."
"I can't imagine."
"Say you're sleeping. You're also dreaming. Inside the dream, you know you're dreaming.
You wake up and you remember you've had a dream, but you also know you were asleep in bed the whole time. You can't remember the details, but you know you had a dream. You also know you stayed in bed for the duration of the dream. A trance is like that. She hit her own ball.
So it's like having two present moments, one physical and one mental.
Exactly. Allison giggled.
You're good at this. Can I hire you instead of John Sousa to be our astronomer?
John swung at his ball with a manic, too-hard swing, hitting it into a pit of sand, lounging smugly in a far corner. It would be hopeless to get it out without several more swings. They were on the 11th hole. There were 15. He could leave soon.
He ran sweaty hands through his hair, staring somewhat cruelly at Tygo.
Your Majesty, it might behoove you to note that this man was a prisoner for treason against your own husband but a few days ago, and just yesterday he did confess to me that he was a con man in a previous existence. Just last night he was unsure if he could even enter a trance, and now he's speaking as though he's some expert. I would say that the evidence I have suggests that he's faking his visionary talent to save his own head.
Tygo smiled again.
You aren't a man of religion, are you? John sneered. You've often reminded me that you abhor magic. Now you have the ability to enter trances. I think the evidence points squarely to these stellar novae being ordinary comets whose paths have brought them nearer than usual to the Earth. He shrugged angrily. Perhaps they will veer away, and we'll see them no more. Perhaps they will hit us.
Tygo's ball waited in the cup. He gestured for Allison to go again before they moved to the next hole.
Well, he said, there's an outlaw carnival camped at our gates. Maybe they know something. Has anyone asked them?
John inhaled.
Our? So you are one of us now?
Tygo smiled thinly. He pointed to John's ball in the sand pit.
Don't you need to get that in before we move on?
John stamped over to it.
I say they're comets, plain and simple. That's what these things usually are. And we have no evidence as yet to the contrary. I say Tygo is an opportunist, and that it was a grave mistake for us to have been taken in by his foolishness.
He hit the ball. It did not come out of the sand. He hit it again. Allison watched, her eyes folding upward like a dancer's arm. He hit the ball hard one last time. At last it flew out of the sand and back into the enclosure, where it nearly connected with Tygo's head. Tygo ducked so quickly that he lost his balance and fell onto the ground. Allison dropped her club and rushed to him, kneeling by him and taking his shoulders in her arms. Incredibly, he was laughing.
He seemed electrified by her closeness, but pulled back as her hands came to rest on his face, near his ear holes.
Tygo dusted himself off.
Are you all right? She whispered, touching his hair.
John turned away just in time to see the Hierophant and the King making strides toward them. Michael, jolly and tranquil as ever, took large steps upon the springy grass, but the Hierophant scowled at them all. His daughter included, his frown visible even from across the golf course.
John Sousa! Michael was calling him now, waving. John Sousa! We have a most urgent need of you.
Michael arrived with muddied boots and a pinkish glow to his already pinkish face. He nodded affably at his wife, who had stepped away from Tygo, but Allison's eyes were locked on her father's, whose frown had transmuted into a grimace of distaste at the sight of her hands upon Tygo.
Daughter, he said through a nearly closed mouth.
She threw her hair behind her shoulders, and then gathered it into a bunch, which she fastened with a ribbon she'd withdrawn from her pocket.
John watched with fascination. She was in her own way the most beautiful woman he had ever seen.
This was a truth that now struck him with a wallop.
Had it been Tygo's appreciation of her that had made him aware of his own?
His cheeks, now burning, embarrassed him. Surely they were red. Michael noticed them too, and clapped him on the back and said,
Yes, it is an oddly nice day, all things considered. Warm, too. We won't have many more of these before the rains come and winter. You should be out and about more, astronomer.
You wouldn't get such a shock from warm weather if you took more time outside. I'll never understand how an astronomer cannot like the outdoors.
I take my outdoor time at night, when the stars are visible.
John sighed. We are a fair race of people, the Sousas, and the data does take much sifting through, and that usually does entail indoor time. Michael laughed.
Yes, yes, of course so. Speaking of the stars, astronomer, I have quite the task for you today. We are greatly in need of a very accurate horoscope about these outlaws. Marvel here is telling me we haven't got time, but I say we can't even consider things properly without one. How quickly could you make one? Would an hour suffice? We'll go to my office to do it.
He began to steer John in the direction of his residence, which abutted the course. Marvel Parsons regarded John narrowly, his arms limp at his side. His eyes were concentrated green gushes of level-headedness, his only visible resemblance to his daughter. Although on her, they were as unrevealing as if they'd been drawn there in chalk. John did not bow to him. Tygo had sense enough to. The Hierophant spoke in a clipped voice.
I received a letter late last night from their leader, a young executioner named Capellatio. He wishes to meet with the king inside the gates, without weapons as an act of good faith. He claims an undeniable proposition concerning the...
He waved his hand toward the sky. Stella Novi.
We should meet with him, broke in Michael. Why not? He may know more than we do, and they haven't threatened us in any way.
There are many reasons not to, replied Marvel. You're not swayed by his obvious breaking of the law, by bringing several carnivals here at the wrong time of year. I'm very displeased by any act of open rebellion.
Michael glanced at John encouragingly, indicating he should join the debate, then said,
I've prayed over it. I feel no conflict, personally. Things do happen to change the law. Miracles. If we don't pay attention at the right time, we may miss them. What sign do you need beyond these two new lights in the sky? If a third appears, we must have no doubt, I think. Something wondrous is happening. I feel it in every bone of my body. I've decided to be excited.
Allison twisted her mouth to the side. Lord Astronomer was just telling us the lights were only comets.
Michael peered at him, dismayed, youthful freckles standing out on his ruddy skin.
Really? How did you arrive at this very intriguing opinion? He demanded.
Marvel smirked, and John, pained, began,
Well, sire, I... You see, I was merely attempting to make a point about basing conclusions on poor data, which was only that we certainly haven't yet given the lights the study they deserve, so any conclusion we draw now would not be even remotely sound. But when there's no time for study, what then? This could be the return, whether you've studied it or not.
Tygo bowed deeply, inserting himself between John and Michael.
Your Majesty, I am Lord Astronomer's assistant. If I may explain, we have begun to study the lights in earnest, but the magic we're using is complicated and difficult to interpret, so we haven't drawn any conclusions, nor would we until we were completely sure that our observations are correct. This must take time. Until then, I think a horoscope is a wonderful idea, if the astronomer agrees.
The king gripped the Hierophant's shoulder and erupted in a merry laugh, which sounded like air blown over the neck of a bottle.
John, I think you cannot refuse. What a catastrophe if we went in blind and it ended horribly.
He eyed Tygo's shackles. Servant, have you done something wrong to be chained up?
Where are your ears?
John watched as Marvel sank deeper into disapproval. The corners of his mouth formed a straight line. His face was a remarkable mask of restraint.
Excuse me, Marvel coughed in a brittle voice, but this is the man I told you about. The convict. Sousa believes he is a visionary.
Now see here, I don't know what he is. I just don't know. Marvel nodded.
One minute he's a visionary, and the next he's a con man. Or a surgeon.
Maybe he's none of those things. Or maybe he